From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made potentially later this week, or as we assume at least later this month, in Washington, when the Senate once again brings up a bill designed to reduce student loan debt. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is behind the bill, which is called the Bank on Students Emergency Loan Refinancing Act. Can it work as intended? When the bill came up this past spring, Republicans filibustered it and the bill went nowhere. Warren is hoping that changes this time around. She's pressuring her colleagues by pointing out that 750,000 people have signed petitions in support of this kind of legislation. Now, the bill targets interest rates paid by students and graduates. Warren points out that many Americans with a student loan debt pay interest rates of 7% or more. She says interest rates are near historic lows for homeowners and businesses, and she wants students and graduates to have a chance to lower the rates. 3.86% for undergrad loans is what she wants, a shade higher for graduates and parent loans. So how to pay for it? Warren would reduce tax loopholes that she says allow millionaires to pay lower tax rates than many middle-class families, and that is a political sticking point that Republicans have said amounts to a tax increase for this bill. So here on Connections, our aim is to focus on policy proposals without getting mired in the politics, if possible. This one's a little harder to do that, but recently we analyzed Republican Congressman Paul Ryan's anti-poverty plan. Today we're looking at Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren's student loan bill and the broader issues that surround it. We welcome Ian Mortimer, Vice President for Enrollment Management at Nazareth College. Ian, nice to see you back here.
Thanks, Evan.
We have on the phone with us from Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Beth Nepa as the Director of Financial Aid. Beth, thank you.
My pleasure.
And we welcome Kent Gardner, the Chief Economist with the Center for Governmental Research here in Rochester. Kent, as always, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Evan.
All right, let's start with some of the words of Senator Warren herself. Here's a comment from Senator Elizabeth Warren explaining why she feels the current structure of loan debt needs to change.
The federal government offers far lower interest rates on loans every single day. They just don't do it for everyone. Right now, a big bank can get a loan through the Federal Reserve discount window at a rate of about 0.75%. But this summer, a student who's trying to get a loan to go to college will pay almost 7%. In other words, the federal government is going to charge interest rates 9 times higher than the rates they charge the biggest banks.
Senator Elizabeth Warren there, and Kent Gardner, she's comparing student loan interest rates to other interest rates. Is that an apples-to-apples comparison?
Well, sure it is. I mean, it's money. It's what cost you what you're being charged to borrow the money. I think that and I think her point at one level is really unassailable. It certainly does look unfair. It looks like the federal government is making a tidy profit on student loan debt. On the other hand, and not only that, but government debt isn't reachable by bankruptcy. While we can look at the default rates, at the same time, these student loans don't go away. So this is not a normal credit market. So sure, on the face of it, I think it's unfair. The question really is, I think, how much we as a society want to invest in encouraging people to go to college and what we're willing to pay for that.
We're going to be talking also about the broader issues, right, of going to college, what we ought to pay, and the return on investment, which I think are all related here. But let me also bring in the folks who work in higher education, and I'll start with you, Ian Mortimer from Nazareth. When you take a look at some of the details of the Warren plan, I know you're working with students all the time coming in. Those students, you hope that they graduate, that they go on to productive careers, but a lot of students graduate with loan debt. Quick thoughts on the broad outlines of the Warren plan?
I think it's a good idea, going to Ken's comment, if the American people feel the government should be the lender for education. One of the things that if this is the way that we go, I would argue that there's a responsibility not only to lend but also to graduate, which we've talked about before. So the more the government takes on, it's just going to require more of more of colleges and universities to ensure that doesn't get defaulted, and we just have to be in sync on that.
Beth Nepa from Hobart and William Smith, thoughts on the Warren bill?
I couldn't agree more. Obviously, it's a huge problem. I think refinancing, having the option of refinancing at a lower interest rate would be crucial, and it would benefit so many people. I think, too, though, it's such a an important topic, and every single school that I've worked at or that I've talked to or at different conferences, we're all talking about your student loan debt and your default rate. And I think it's a big responsibility of the school to make sure that they are being, that their financial aid office is being upfront with their student borrowers and letting them know what they're getting themselves into, so that they have the education behind what reality is.
If you want to join the program, we'll take your calls and questions, and we've already have at least one caller lined up to do that. We're going to be getting to the phones in just a moment. We've also been asking on social media for folks if they're willing to share their stories with student loan debt and interest rates. We've seen interest rates from around 2.5% all the way up to 10.5% reported. And that is, obviously, it's a broad range. It's kind of what Senator Warren is talking about. In terms of the policy and the politics, Republicans filibustered it because they didn't like, at the very least, they didn't like the mechanism to pay for the Warren bill, which is, they say it's a tax on the wealthy. I think Senator Warren says it's not a new tax, it's closing loopholes. That will get hashed out this week and this month going forward to see if that changes. But we're looking at the actual impact on if the sort of the structure of student loan debt changes here. And before we get to the phones here, you know, Ken, you look at what students are paying, and I'm not, oh boy, the phones are on fire. Wow, people want to talk about this. See, I'm not an expert in what bankruptcy does to the equation, whether bankruptcy protection has an impact or not. I know that's come up for you. Explain more about why that's a factor here.
Well, I think what's clear is that this isn't a normal credit market. I mean, typically, one of the reasons we get ourselves all kind of tangled up in knots over this question, and I could debate both sides of this with myself to a standstill, I think, we don't allow normally, and again, this has shades going back to the housing crisis. Normally, a credit market comes to a person and says, you know, I'm going to loan you money, and I'm going to expect to get paid back, and I'm going to do an analysis of the probability that I'm really going to get my money back. Now, federal government doesn't do that. It says pretty much anybody who qualifies and is going to go to an accredited institution, gets accepted at an accredited institution, is going to get their money. Except that we're not going to let you off the hook eventually. I mean, normally when the lender makes a mistake and they lend money to somebody who can't pay it back, the consequence of that is maybe that they default on the debt, they go through bankruptcy, and the lender doesn't get their money back. But that's not the way it works here. So we're not really asking the question of whether we're making an investment in someone who's likely to pay it back. You know, but the problem is, and this is where I start arguing with myself, if you decide that you're only going to lend money to people who, from a college perspective, are a good credit risk, then you're going to be lending only to people who are middle class and have had a good education in high school and come in with good grades and, you know, good SATs and all that sort of thing, because they're much better credit risk. And so we choose to extend the program more broadly because we want to offer the opportunity to go to college to a broader cross-section of the American public.
There's another critique that I've been seeing over the last 4 months, generally from conservatives who have opposed this, and they say, and again, I don't know all the machinations here, they say that Senator Warren is wrong, that current students can absolutely refinance loans right now if they so choose, and that there's sort of a myth here involved here. I mean, can I ask our panel, I mean, Ian as well, can students refinance right now? Because Senator Warren has said they, in many ways, she's saying they can't.
Well, graduates can refinance their loans if they're federal loans, and Beth can speak much more accurately to this than I, but when a student graduates, they have the ability to refinance at different intervals depending on different programs.
Okay, and here's a quote from Senator Warren in a piece that she herself wrote. She said, homeowners refinance their loans when interest rates go down. Businesses refinance their loans, but right now there's no way for students to be able to do that. Now, she does make the distinction there, students, not necessarily graduates. But Beth, can you help clarify there who's able to refinance?
Sure, absolutely. When a student graduates or leaves school and they have, you know, many different loans, they can consolidate. So it's not called refinancing, but it is consolidating their loans. And then they can pick up an interest rate that's basically prorated. It's an average of the interest rates that they had over their tenure in school, over their loan plans that they have.
And Beth, do you have numbers of default rates handy? I only ask because I saw a lot of conflicting data on that.
Well, you know what? I can tell you, I can speak for the colleges. We've been below 2% since I've been here, and that's going over 8 years. So we have a very low discount rate. I think where the higher discount rates are coming from are the for-profit colleges, unfortunately. And there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of borrowers. And a lot of those students are walking away without degrees. They're not finishing their programs. And it has a huge effect on everybody else. That's, I think, over 46% of the students in default are coming from for-profit schools.
Now, Evan, can I ask Beth about what you just said? I just want to confirm. You're saying when you consolidate loans, if you've got a loan at 7 and you got a loan at 9 and they're the equal amount, you can consolidate them and make it 8. But you can't refinance in the sense that if you've got a loan that's got an average of 8, but there's a, you know, the new borrowers, the folks who are just coming into the government loan market, can borrow at 3, you can't refinance to 3. Is that the way this
works?
You
don't get a piece of that pie. That's correct.
Yeah, so that's the piece rate. I think that is unfair, and that's where I would agree with Senator
Warren. Absolutely couldn't agree more.
Okay, so we've got at least some agreement there on the bill. But Kent, before I even go forward and take any more calls, you've said you're not even comfortable alighting on a single position when it comes to bankruptcy protection. If you had to choose, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, actually, if I had to choose, what I would do is go back to an old system of both credit, both loans and grants. I think people who are probably not traditionally credit worthy when you're thinking about student loan debt probably should be given more grants. And we should give those grants, you know, based on people's – not strictly on people's academic potential, but I think that we should have – that we should give people money on softer terms. So, you know, kind of separate the goals. We're trying to improve access to college for people who are – you know, are not coming from the middle class, then I think a grant is a much better way to go. And the other problem, and you alluded to it earlier, is that, you know, you get an 18-year-old in your office and you say you're going to borrow all this money, but you'll be able to pay it back. Sure you will. I mean, I really think of this as kind of an unholy conspiracy in which the colleges, you know, apologies to my fellow panelists here, the colleges are complicit.
Well, if I can just maybe follow up on
please
that.
Do,
I mean, one of the things that we've implemented this year at our institution is a very aggressive financial literacy program. So we're disincentivized in the long run to have over-leveraged students and students that go into default. And so not only for the betterment of the college, but also the betterment of the student and the family, being as transparent as we possibly can in terms of what those amounts are and helping them budget their future earnings in correlation with their major and all other kinds of inputs.
Beth Hobart and William Smith, is there a similar approach?
Oh, I'm so proud of what we're able to do here. And we're a staff of 4. And we have an open-door policy. And our students know this, the personalized service that they get. They walk in here, everything's dropped. Families walk in. We actually counsel students, even if they have a refund coming to them, we will call them and let them know, hey, listen, John, you have a refund of $640 sitting in your account. What we recommend you do is pay down what you owe right now. Let us reduce your loan. Unless you need that money for something else, we do that for anybody who has a refund coming to them. You know, so we're just, it's the personalized service. It's letting them know that this is real. It's going to be with you. And how can we help you manage it?
Kent Gardner directed me to a piece that I found fascinating in The Atlantic that looked at for-profit law schools nationwide. So, again, we've been talking whether certain comparisons are apples to apples or apples to anvils. But in this case, you've got you don't have a large number of for-profit law schools. But the piece opens with this look at some of the dysfunction there. And the comparison that is drawn is if you go back to the subprime mortgage crisis from, what is that now, seven, eight years ago. And you had, you know, I try not to generalize or speak too broadly, but you had subprime, you had people who probably should not be granted loans, be getting loans, and then their mortgages were chopped up and sort of hidden in these trenches and parts of investments, and it was very complex. But people were getting loans they shouldn't have gotten. And in this case, this piece looks at for-profit law schools as a way of sort of in that similar, almost pernicious, predatory kind of scenario, Ken. And I'm not grouping in a Nazareth or a Hobart William Smith, but I think the larger question is, does it get to be a point where it's, hey, we're admitting people who can't afford to pay, you know, but we want to help them, or to the point where it's almost venal, you know, and
you know. Well, I don't think it's almost venal. you know, I think we can go all the way to say that it's venal.
Okay.
It's I do think that there are organizations, there are institutions out there that are taking advantage of the availability of student loans. It's a great business. You know, I think we should do what we can to pull that back. I'm not quite so willing, as I said earlier, to quite let, you know, the other institutions off the hook. I think every college president is happy to say that, to point out the statistics and say that a college degree is worth the money. Well, you know, it's worth the money on average, but that doesn't mean that a college degree and taking on college debt is worth it for every child who wants to go to college.
I think it's important too. I mean, I can't tell you how, you know, I've had families sit in front of me and their child wants to be here, and we've run the figures. Everything that I can do for them, I have to counsel them out. You know, I have to say, this is just not going to be a good decision for you. And the parents appreciate it because they don't have the ability to meet their contribution, let alone any gap that they might have, if they have a gap. Parent PLUS loans, if a parent is, and this is across the board, any institution, if a parent is denied the federal PLUS loan for parents, students are automatically eligible for additional unsubsidized loan money. Most schools out there are just going to put that unsubsidized fund, just tack it on to the student's account, and the student really doesn't know it most of the time. Here at HWS, if any time a parent is denied, we reach out to the student and family and let them know, you have this as an option, but we want to hear back from you that you, in fact, want to take advantage of this option. We're not just going to assume that you want us to add on to your loan debt. You know, it's a big responsibility in the aid office just to really educate their borrowers.
I want to thank our callers who've been patient. We will get to you in just a moment. If you're just joining us, we're talking about Senator Elizabeth Warren's student loan debt bill that could get a vote or could get filibustered again in the Senate very soon, as it did in the spring. And we're also talking about the wider question of return on investment from college degree. And we've got a panel helping us understand these issues. Kent Gardner is here from the Center for Governmental Research in Rochester. Ian Mortimer is the Vice President for Enrollment Management at Nazareth College. And on the phone from Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Beth Nepa is the Director of Financial Aid. Again, if you're just joining us, the Warren bill would allow students and graduates who have loan debt to refinance at lower rates in the same way that many other folks in other different sectors are refinancing for lower rates and essentially moving from 7, 8, 9% down to between 3.5% and 4% kind of on average. And one other quick critique here before we get to the phones. This comes from National Review Online and Jason Richwise writing, and I want to get our panel's take on Jason's comments, which are making the rounds this week as we prepare to see a vote on the Warren bill if it happens. He writes, quote, "As I noted last spring, students already have the right to refinance their loans. They can go to any private lender and ask for a lower rate, just as homeowners and businesses can. The reason that few students do, of course, is that they are getting a great deal already, a generous government subsidy on their existing federal direct or federally guaranteed loans. Private lenders are rarely in a position to offer better terms. The Warren bill would allow students to refinance with the federal government, but why should taxpayers agree to accept lower interest payments? In the private sector, lenders will allow refinancing only if they fear losing loans to their competitors offering lower rates. But the federal government, which charges below market interest rates, has no serious competition for student loans. It's not unreasonable to believe that student debt is excessive, and lowering the prior interest rate would be one way to relieve the burden. But when Senator Warren says her bill merely puts students on a refinancing par with homeowners and businesses, it does the whole student loan debate a disservice." End quote. Again, that's Jason Richwise from National Review Online. Kent Gardner?
Well, you know, I'm trying to parse out all those different pieces. I mean, you know, again, as I said, I think if we went to a standard credit market, then we'd ask the question of what the odds are of an individual child paying the loan back. And yeah, these are really risky loans. And yes, 7, 8, 9% is probably a pretty good deal if you've got a really risky loan. I mean, that's kind of the way the credit markets work. The reason the federal government can do it is because they, you know, prohibit students from actually discharging these debts under bankruptcy, except in very unusual circumstances. So it actually, on a purely financial basis, it's really not a bad deal for taxpayers. Taxpayers are going to get that money eventually from the government loans. And he's right that students can't take the most students can't take those loans and have a private lender take them out with a lower interest rate. So they're all right.
I think context.
Go ahead, Ian, yeah.
I think context also is important in that having the federal government be the primary lender for all students is it's a relatively new process. Before 2010 or 2011, I can't remember the exact year. Banks as well as student lending organizations, we're essentially competing for business. And then 3 or 4 years ago, Senator Kennedy's bill came in and essentially mandated that colleges and universities use the federal government. And so I think one of the questions on the table would be, was the system before that, taking out some of the unscrupulous behavior that was happening with banks and lenders out of the equation, but was that a better system? Because there was an element of competition between banks to earn the business of students.
Beth, you want to weigh in as well?
Yeah, I think about what I say to students, and I say it's really my mantra is exhaust any federal avenue before you go to the private sector. Typically, you do have private lenders that will give you a fixed rate. There's not many. They're mostly variable rates that I've heard of, and that's kind of scary. And a lot of banks have to look at your credit rating, and our students really don't have a credit rating to look at when trying to secure an interest rate. So I've always said, exhaust, the federal government first before looking at that private sector.
And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, has offered some ideas for why his caucus has not been willing to support this bill. He said tuition costs are up 500% in higher education since 1985, and the truth is not everybody needs to go to Yale. That's from Senator Mitch McConnell. He followed up by saying that the best solution to the loan debt crisis is more and better jobs across the country. So let's take some calls, and we appreciate you waiting. This is Sue in Fairport. Sue, thanks for calling Connections.
Hi. I think the premise that this and so many other things need to be paid for, quote. If you follow that, I think the military action in the Middle East should also be paid for. And having said that, now you can watch the Republicans throw up.
Oh, okay. But thank you, Sue. I appreciate the point. I think Senator Warren has offered her thoughts on paying for it. And she has said in interviews that I've been reading that she does think that it's important to look at the fact that the federal government is profiting off of these loans to the tune of about, I think she said, $66 billion over the last half decade. And so her point is, if that money is going to be gone, we can make up for it. And she wants to see tax loopholes closed and seeing essentially the wealthy pay a higher tax burden.
But that really does drag you into politics.
Well, that's where it goes into
ideology,
politics.
Right?
Yes, yeah, that's where it goes into politics. And that's also why it got filibustered 3 months ago and could get filibustered again.
Yeah, but this would cost money, and there's no question about that. I mean, CBO has estimated how much that it's going to cost a lot of money. If you want to do this, it costs money. You got to find the money someplace. I don't think that the government is not a bottomless well of cash.
Yeah, and I think even Senator Warren has said the same. All right, this is Diana in Rochester. Diana, thanks for calling Connections.
Hi. There are really only 2 points I want to make. The first is I have a lot of concern about the for-profit colleges that go out with very aggressive advertising and have extremely low graduation rates, also true for many of the online schools. I think that has to do with accreditation and tracking. And I think we've also made the mistake of not having this kind of accreditation and tracking for other types of education, whether it's a trade or an art, because college isn't for everyone.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, Diana, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Beth.
Yeah, no, Diana, I couldn't agree, and I really appreciate her comments. When you look at the for-profit schools, you have to look at their default rates, and I'm not sure why the federal government is still lending to those institutions that continue to have incredibly high interest rates. It's hurting everyone. And I think that there's got to be a point where that legislation goes into effect, where if you are over a certain discount or a default rate 2 years in a row or 3 years in a row, you get yanked. You can't lend to your student population.
And she brought up, before I even move it to what she talked about, graduation rates versus default rates. I mean, I know, go ahead, Kent, and Ian, if you wanted to weigh in there.
I was going to say, I think especially in our region, the relevancy of the investment in a college degree compared to the job market is also important. And the reason I say that is that the growing sector of our employment market is in middle skills jobs. So not essentially a credential after high school, but some kind of training. After high school, and MCC has done an exceptional job of.
Hold on one second. Hey, Raj, I'm hearing a phone ringing on the air. I don't know. That's very strange.
We're sorry.
Oh, now I'm hearing even more.
Your telephone is temporarily
up. I think we lost Beth. Is what happened. Maybe we can get Beth back on the line. Sorry about that. Ian, go ahead.
I was just going to say that especially for individuals that are seeking employment in this area and want to stay in this area, looking at the association between that investment and what that will. The job opportunities within Rochester is really, really important. This region has one of the lower bachelor's degree requirements within the employment market of a lot of areas in the country. And so, again, if you're going to invest thoroughly in a four-year degree, just ensure that you have a channel from which you're going to get the return on that from an employment perspective.
And we talked about graduation rates. Nazareth College graduation rate is, I guess, comparatively pretty solid, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very good for a school of our peer and quality, yeah. Yeah.
Are you? Did we hear a number? Are you allowed to say what the number is? Is
that 63%.
63%. And I think what's interesting is some people hear that and they think, oh, that's very good, and some people think, wow, it's just 63%. Because when you begin the process of education, whether it's a 4-year degree or something else, especially if you're taking on loan debt, it's a disastrous decision, isn't it, Kent, to not end up with a degree to show for it?
Well, that's what the article in The Atlantic talked about with these law schools, too, that folks take out these big loans and then they come out with it. Either they don't get a degree at all, or they come out with a degree that's nearly useless. I mean, we talk about how tough it is for graduates to service their debts, but what about the folks who don't get a degree? You spend 2 years and you've amassed $20,000 in debt, and then you have absolutely no way to pay that down. I mean, it's tragic.
And if we agree that defaulting on a student loan is the worst possible outcome of this whole process, then looking at the data, the amount borrowed does not correlate to default rates. The net cost of an institution does not correlate to default rates. And getting to the point that we're talking about, the only data point that correlates directly is graduation rates. And so, if we're talking about student loans and debts and these pieces, it's obviously very, very important. But the broader conversation that I wish, would be, part of the media's agenda as well as the government's agenda is how do we get people through the system, knowing that if they get through, the return on whatever they borrow or whatever they spend is going to be exponentially higher.
Well, once again, if normal credit markets would pay attention to that.
Right.
But we have created a system in which we make it easy for people to take on this debt because we believe, and I still believe, that college education is a pathway to the mainstream economy. I mean, Burning Glass did released a report last week where they looked at up-credentialing. They talked about how executive assistants, for example, that 75% of the people 75% of those jobs now require a bachelor's degree, and yet if you look at the population as a whole, people who currently occupy those positions, I think it's something like 19% actually hold a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. So do you need a bachelor's degree or not? Well, you certainly need one to get the job. Do you need one to do the job? I think that's an open question.
Yeah, I agree.
Beth Nepa from Hobart and William Smith, Ian Mortimer from Nazareth telling us that their graduation rate's very solid and solidly above average there. Do you have that data? How's the graduation rate at Hobart and William Smith?
I don't have the actual number in front of me. It's great, and actually it continues to go up. We have our Pathways program, actually, which is our career services, is second to none. We are working with our freshmen right out of the gate, all through the 4 years that they're here, to get them to really think about what they want to do, get them in those spots where they think that they want to be working, and get those internships. Every single student is guaranteed a paid internship here at the colleges, and that's huge. You got to get them out there. But our rates are great and only getting higher.
All right, let's take a very short break here, come back with more callers who are waiting to talk about the issue of student loan debt, interest rates, and more. And you can also jump on social media. A lot of people sharing their own stories on what they're paying, what they're still paying. You're hearing a lot of people around 6%, 7%, 8% or more. And that's what the Elizabeth Warren student loan bill would address if it happens to pass this month or any time. So short break, and back with more with you on Connections next. Coming up in our second hour, you can be forgiven if occasionally you have a hard time telling if you're looking at news or advertising, whether it's online, on news websites, in traditional magazine journalism, or even in newspapers. The lines are starting to blur between news and PR, and a conference at RIT this Friday takes aim at exactly that. We'll touch on that and more next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Before we get back to the phones now, Ian Mortimer from Nazareth College, are graduation rates in higher education in general? Generally, and again, there are lots of ways that we can kind of break it down, but in general, is it a failing of American higher education, graduation rates?
You know, I'm not sure if I'd say it's a failure, but I think that's where the dialogue should be focused. I mean, again, if we go to the economics of the challenge, it does point to graduation rates as being the indicator from which you are most at risk from a student loan default perspective. And it's also, you know, to the point made earlier, your access to a better job and a better opportunity for your life. So if we agree that those two things are true, then we need to do more, not only as a higher education system, but also as a society, ensuring our students are prepared as they need to be coming out of K-12, but also once they arrive, you know, how are we, you know, catering to the needs and to the learning styles and all these different pieces of students going through the process.
And before I get over to Beth, Kent, follow-up thoughts on that?
Well, the one thing I think to remember about graduation rates is that the graduation rates in higher ed are higher in institutions that attract a better prepared student.
Yep.
No great surprise, right? So if you're looking at some of the for-profits and two-year schools that have much lower graduation rates, and it's partly because they're dealing with a student that is a more marginal entrant into the workforce, and arguably a student who stands to benefit more from a higher ed degree. So, I mean, I don't think that graduation rates is the only thing to look at with respect to default rates. Again, I'd rather see us go to more grants. That's probably not going to happen. It's pretty easy to say to the taxpayers, we're going to loan people money, and we're going to, you know, make sure they pay it back eventually, you know.
Beth, thoughts on graduation rates and that correlation?
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, especially looking at our own default rates over the years, even on those kids that leave the colleges for one reason or another. And I couldn't agree more that it's the gift aid that needs to be there to help reduce that student loan, you know, on all of our students that are applying for financial aid, not just the middle class. Certainly there's all different pockets of populations that need this assistance. But again, I don't think it's just graduation rates. I would totally agree with that.
Bob in Brighton, thanks for waiting. Go ahead, Bob.
Thank you for taking my call. I mean, it's a very interesting topic. And as I think you noted, very complex at a certain level when you think of it in a context. Context is, I can't believe I'm agreeing with this, why Mitch McConnell's point of saying, why has tuition overall raised at a rate of 500% or whatever? I know this, having taught at the college level. Why has that gone up so high, particularly given the number of adjuncts who are teaching as a percentage of the faculties? So it really raises, first of all, the question of the cost itself. And the next level is, why is that a college education is being deemed as so important from a, quote, job perspective, and that corporations per se have stopped, for the most part, I'm talking large corporations, not small businesses, have dropped training programs and development programs as part of their cost cutting, even though they're extraordinarily profitable according to the data. So I'd like to hear what your panel and yourself think about those items. Thanks very much.
Bob, thanks for the call. Senator Elizabeth Warren said that you don't have a chance in the middle class without a college degree. She said you have to have a degree, or you have to have college experience, college degree to have a chance in the middle class. Our caller Diana earlier this hour said college is not for everybody, in the same way Mitch McConnell did, to Bob's point there. I'll start with Ian. How do you sort of reconcile those ideas? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the first point's an excellent one in terms of lack of apprenticeship programs in the U.S. And so there was a data point that said that the U.S. has one quarter of the approved apprenticeship programs as Canada. And that's not as a percentage, but as an aggregate. So I do think there's huge opportunity for that. And I think that's an absolutely great great point. In terms of, you know, the cost of higher ed, there's a couple things that, you know, we look at and try and look at this data and compare it to the institutions that students are looking at in comparison to us. And the first is, you know, we have an advertised price, which is our tuition and room and board that is, you know, approved by the Board of Trustees, et cetera. But then, you know, we have a separate approval process, which is our financial aid budget. And over the last 4 years, you know, and this is, I would argue, consistent with most private institutions that are within our peer group, the net cost to the family has been relatively flat for the past 5 years. So when you take our incremental increase of, you know, 3% or whatever it is year over year, and then you take a look at our increase in our financial aid budget, it's essentially a net, it's a flat line in terms of what students or families are actually paying. And for a place like ours, where 98% are receiving financial aid, you know, that's the majority of our students. And so there's a kind of a market, what the market will bear piece to this. And the way that a lot of private institutions, you know, manage that is that they'll look at, you know, essentially, you know, where they fit in terms of their value, and then, you know, trying to attract the best and the brightest and provide access as much as we possibly can using financial aid dollars.
And to some degree, it's sort of unfair for Beth and Ian to have to answer questions about why the cost of higher ed's gone up in the last 30 years the way it has, because that's not exactly your job. But Ian's point about flat cost in the last 5 years sort of reminds me of people who point out that in the last 10 years, global warming has been sort of flat, so maybe it's, you know, not as bad. The long term is still a remarkable change in 30 years, isn't it?
Well, not exactly. I mean, you know? I think that there's a technical point to be made here. And I've had the conversation with Ian's boss, actually, a few years ago over a cup of coffee, bemoaning how colleges feel that they have to keep increasing the retail price. And it's a game that's really, I think, a disease in higher ed, that we keep raising the retail price and increasing our financial aid budget at the same time. So 98% of the students getting financial aid, I mean, that sounds a little odd, doesn't it? I mean, I think what it really means is that we've raised the sticker price and everybody gets a little bit of a discount. And when you go into a new car dealer, I mean, do you actually pay the price on the true sticker price on the window? Hardly anyone does. And unfortunately, higher ed has adopted that kind of a marketing technique. And so, in fact, the official statistics, we only have really good data for about the last 5 or 6 years about what the true cost of college is. And so when, Senator McConnell and others talk about those long-term statistics, they're using the posted prices, and the posted prices have been inflated.
I think that's obviously a hugely important point. And Beth Nepa from Hobart and William Smith, I'm sure you've talked to plenty of parents who see the sticker price, and you probably have to sit down with them. And I the last I checked a few months ago, something along the lines of 80 to 90% of Hobart and William Smith students are not paying that top price. Is that right?
About 86% of our students are on some type of financial aid, and it's true. And if I had written notes about this topic, this very topic, I think Ian probably just stole them and read exactly what I would have said. As our costs increase, our aid budget increases with it. I think a lot of private schools, are the same. You have to be. You have to.
But if I can be fussy, Beth, I mean, you say not as your cost increases, but as your price increases. Price and cost are two different things. And colleges have been raising prices, and it's become difficult for us to figure out actually what's been happening to their actual costs.
I can provide some input on that. I mean, and this is not a thorough analysis, but I can share in terms of, you know, what we struggle with in terms of managing our costs. And education, whether it's K through 12 or higher ed, currently is a very human capital, labor intensive venture. And to have good quality people teaching students and counseling students and coaching students and you know, providing what families and students expect. Human beings are very expensive when you include healthcare costs, which go up, you know, exponentially every year, and trying to, keep that cost low. The other thing that families are requiring of us, and rightfully so, is keeping the curriculum content updated and relevant, and that comes with costs. And there's also this, unfortunately, kind of amenities, competition, you know, so in terms of, you know, residence halls and organic food and, you know, kind of the best facilities. If there was one kind of market-driven piece that I wish would slow down, that would be it, because I think if we're really stripping down the costs of what it takes to educate someone, that's going to look a little bit different than the cost of what it, someone expects in terms of their experience.
And I think looking forward to the higher education market is going to be challenged tremendously over the next 10 years. As enrollments don't rise the way that they did for many years. Enrollments have been sagging for the last few, and they're probably going to continue for a while. But we're going to face incredible competition, not only for the for-profits, but take a look at, Arizona State University, which now has, they do a drive time piece on NPR. I don't know how many degrees they now offer completely online. In Arizona State, and that's not University of Arizona, which is a different, or I mean University of Phoenix, which is a very different game. But when you see Arizona State getting into the online business aggressively, I think it signals a real change in what that online business could mean for higher ed.
If I can just maybe add a point to that, we did a study to kind of get a sense of our adult market, who we were competing against, and about a third of the competition within our adult and graduate space were institutions not in the greater Rochester region. So big brands, you know, are developing online platforms, asynchronous learning platforms, mm-hmm. Are absolutely getting into the game.
And Beth, I want to just circle back and make sure I understand a point, if we could. You said that 86% of HWS students today are on some sort of financial aid. How would that compare to 10, 20, 25 years ago?
Oh, geez.
I know you don't have those figures necessarily offhand, but is it remarkably more? Is it reasonably close?
I would have to guess. If I had to guess, I would have to say that it is remarkably more, and it is because, you know, of the cost increase. And when I talk about cost, I don't talk about, like, when Ian was discussing what it really costs to educate a student. I'm really looking at our comprehensive fees, the tuition, the room and board, you know, the mandated fees. That's what I'm looking at. So I would have to say it's more. I'm seeing more, you know, just in the 8 years that I've been here, I'm seeing more kids apply for financial aid. And quite frankly, I encourage students, even if they don't think they're going to be eligible, to apply for financial aid, because you just never know what you're going to receive at some institutions. Some institutions have pockets of money for those that don't even, you know, qualify. So I always put it out there to apply. But then just going back to what Ian was just talking about, the value proposition, that's what it's going to come down to. We will see schools going out of business. We will. And parents, anymore, they want to know about the outcome. That's the most important thing to them. Obviously, they want, you know, their students to be, it has to be affordable. But the outcome, what are we doing to make this education something that their students are going to be able to use as soon as they walk out the door?
Back to the phones in Rochester. This is Pete. Pete, go ahead.
Good afternoon. The Atlantic Magazine attempted to answer one of your questions, titled, "Here's exactly how much the government would have to spend to make public college college tuition free." And the grand total is a mere $62.6 billion. According to a new Department of Education data, that's how much tuition public colleges collected from undergraduates in 2012 across the entire United States. And I'm not being facetious with the word near either. The New American Foundation says the federal government spent a whole $69 billion in 2013 on its hodgepodge of financial aid programs, such as Pell Grants for low-income students, tax breaks, work-study funding, and that doesn't even include loans. That's the first paragraph of the article. Any of you familiar with that?
I am not. That's interesting data.
No,
thank you for sharing.
Okay. Now, I frequently hear about, the cost of college. Yes, it costs money, but this is an investment. the value we as a nation and as a society, as a civilized society, receive in return is much greater than this investment. So the cost and what we get in return for value is something that is, people need to understand. There's a difference between an investment and an expense. College education is an investment for our future.
Pete, thanks for the call, Pete. And let me ask the economist briefly, because we could spend a whole other hour on the implications of making higher education free for all. But if the Atlantic has looked at the number and it's in the $60 billion plus range.
Yeah, I've not seen the number, so okay. I don't know what assumptions they put into calculating.
But where would that kind of a conversation start with in terms of actual affordability and what would need to sort of the dominoes that would take place?
Well, first, it's not going to be a static number. If you suddenly make something free, then other people are going to start demanding it, right? So it certainly, if that is the current expenditure of public institutions, what about all the private institutions? I mean, that's why I think I'd really need to dissect the number and be able to respond intelligently.
Yeah, sorry. Gotcha. Ian Mortimer from Nazareth College, you've been talking about graduation rates. Real briefly here, if this is such an important piece now, at Nazareth, nearly two-thirds graduate. And that's, again, that's a good number. But that's still a third who are not. What can be done and what is being done to change that number?
A lot. You know, we have all kinds of, you know, new programs, which, you know, to get to the cost piece, which you know, we talked about earlier. In terms of, you know, peer advising and coaching, and we've implemented an upgrade to our first-year experience, which has lifted our first-year retention rate by about 4 percentage points, which is a good indicator of better graduation rates. I think the thing that I'm very pleased about is that the whole concept of student success and graduation rates has really evangelized our community. So faculty, staff, leadership, the board is completely on board on this topic because they know that a lot of our future success is tied to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to go up even from two-thirds, doesn't it? I mean, I know it's yeah. You're better than average.
Yeah.
But that's got to move.
Absolutely, up.
And Ian and Beth, quick question for you. I mean, I think back to my days at the Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University, and I remember as a wide-eyed freshman walking across the quad, and I felt like everybody I met was just general education, we'll figure it out later, you know, we're happy to be here. I think I paid $6,000 a year, you know, and it was... it's a bit of a different world now. I keep assuming that there are a lot fewer general education or whatever you'd call undeclared, I guess, is another. Is it wise not to go to school undeclared, and are there fewer undeclared, or is that just my imagination? I'll start with Ian.
I think some schools are better at serving undeclared populations than other. So to answer your question, no. I mean, just the fact that you don't know exactly what you want to do is actually an argument that you should, you know, immerse yourself more within a four-year environment. About 20% of our students every year come in undeclared, mm-hmm. and even those who have a major, about a third change.
But that number hasn't fallen in recent years.
This year was the first year it's dipped a little bit, but for the most part it's been consistent.
Beth, what about Hobart and William-Smith?
The majority of our students are coming in undeclared, and that's why so much has been put into this Pathways program that we have, starting out with the first-year students to really give an assessment of their interests and their skills and their values, and working with them, you know, like I said, from day one, getting those internships so that they can really kind of get a feel for what they thought they might be interested in. So, and it's just not the career service staff. I mean, and they're remarable, but it's the campus community that, you know, just wraps their arms around these kids to, you know, put them in the right direction and make sure that they're comfortable in that direction that they're going in.
That's why I'm not a financial advisor. Kent, is the notion of undeclared, has that changed in your mind as an economist?
I think that the challenge of young people going to college and, you know, whether taking out these massive loans or simply foregoing other opportunities, I do think we need to think about whether that makes sense. And, you know, what we haven't really broached is the question of whether this whole four-year model is broken. There have been a lot of, I think, very authoritative voices arguing that we really should rethink the whole thing. And, you know, having taught college freshmen, I know that for a lot of college freshmen, this is very much a consumption good. You know, they're coming in looking to have a good time, and that's fine. But I think we have to question how much we want to subsidize that. You know, I've often thought that a year of public service after high school before folks go to college would completely transform higher education. We'd have students who are much more focused on what they wanted to do and what they had in mind for their life work.
And just 15 seconds, Kent, you said this is sort of small bore issue in the larger. We talked about the Elizabeth Warren's debt bill, but this is it's going to get a lot of ink, but you think in the grand scheme of things it's sort of small bore.
Yeah, this is just a financial piece, and I you know, there are arguments on both sides. It's it does come to a really – it does – partly it is a question of affordability. It's how we want to spend our money. This is not a cheap thing to do.
Kent Gardner from the Center for Governmental Research, always nice to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Beth Nepa from Hobart and William Smith, thanks for carving out an hour for us this afternoon, Beth. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Ian Mortimer from Nazareth, and we've talked on the notion of not only making higher education more approachable and accessible, but also helping people graduate. And we'll continue that conversation with you because I know you have a lot to say, and thanks for sharing your expertise.
Thanks for everything.
Short break, and coming back with more next on this Monday afternoon on Member Supported Public Radio.